This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Thank you very much, Dave, and thank you very much to you, Sir Francis, for coming along and answering our questions.
Well, it's a pleasure to see this organisation at work. It's great.
Now, I have an admission to make. When I was working here as a postdoctoral research associate, one of the things that you do is that you write research papers. You're supposed to. And they get handed around after you write them to people internal to Jodrell Bank for them to be checked. And one of my papers landed on the desk of Sir Francis here. And actually two of them did. And one of them came back, and I got some comments written very neatly on my draft. And he said, let's have a chat about this. And we sat down in the library, and he looked at me and he said, "You haven't actually done very much, have you?" Which was done in such a wonderful way. But that paper did get published. Didn't actually get referenced very much, but it did get published. The other time that you refereed internally one of my papers, all I got was a neat pencil tick in the upper right-hand corner of the cover page.
Oh, well, you'd improve.
And I was told by my betters that this was high praise from Sir Francis. He had just come back with a with a tick on my paper. So I thought,
well, you ought to realise that I'm just getting my own back, because when I was a student, exactly the same thing happened to me. I was told, "Well, Smith, that was a very good paper. There are just 50 minor."
Well, it never changed in my career as it was, short as it was. I had colleagues in the States who would write comments on my paper as long as the paper was itself. So you kind of wonder, well, why don't we just publish your comments and be done with it? But anyway, thank you very much indeed for coming and giving us a chat. Now, I could start off by describing your career and activities at Jodrell Bank Observatory and elsewhere, but then it'll just be me talking for half an hour, which is not really the point. So I would like to ask you just to start off, please, by telling us about what it was like to work here in the early days.
Oh, in the early days, that does go back a bit. You see, I started radio astronomy in Cambridge, right in the very beginning when it wasn't even called radio astronomy. So I came here after the big telescope was in operation and before the Mark II telescope was in operation. And I had some ideas in my head as to what would be interesting to work on, scintillation and other variable things in radio astronomy. And I was also very keen on interferometry. And I think I did influence a bit the development of interferometry at Jodrell Bank based on what had happened at Cambridge. So that was my main interest. Then, of course, the interest in pulsars started up later. That's another really quite exciting story.
Let's talk about interferometry, because it was pretty much the start of this entire field of observational astrophysics, if you like, was interferometry with radio waves. And did it start in Cambridge?
It started in Cambridge, yes. They were starting up in Australia, in Sydney as well, actually. And interestingly, I think it derived in both places from wartime work, because the people in Cambridge and in Sydney had both been involved in radar in the war. Martin Ryle, for example, was concerned with installing antennas on fighters, things like the Beaufighter. And instead of just putting one antenna in the nose and using that as a transmitter and receiver, they put one in each wing. And they found that essentially they were building an interferometer. He got back to Cambridge and then wanted to measure the radio waves from the sun. And he wanted to distinguish the sun from everything else in the sky. So he built an interferometer. And that was about the time that I came and joined him. When we'd built a simple interferometer, then we found that we could pick up other things in the universe. Astonishingly, nobody knew at that time that there were things in Cygnus, in Cassiopeia, Crab Nebula, in Taurus. And we built interferometers just to detect those. Then we went on to build an interferometer which could measure accurately their positions. Accurately in those days meant a minute of arc. These days it means, you know, thousandths of an arc second.
How long did it take you to realize that you, well, maybe you knew right from the start, but did it dawn on you as a gradual thing that you were basically starting a whole new field of observation?
I don't think we really understood the way we fitted into astronomy. We used to think that we were looking at our own universe, and we really rather disregarded what everybody else in astronomy was doing. We learnt that lesson gradually as we began to integrate what we were doing with what everybody else was doing. And we slowly became to think of ourselves as part of astronomy. Of course, we always thought we were the most important part, but then everybody does, don't they?
Yes. What was remind us of the prevailing view of the cosmos back in the time when you were starting work on interferometry? Because it was very different to what we understand now.
Yes. I think the galaxy was about as far as you went in the universe in really understanding anything and getting a picture of the universe. There were obviously other galaxies as well, but there was no idea that you could ever observe things in the really distant or really early universe. There were, of course, theories. There were plenty of people around. We used to talk to McCrae quite a lot. There was Hoyle and Bondi. They all had their own ideas about the universe. But there was very little observational work, any evidence to go on. So that I think we were more interested in the objects which we saw, which were mostly in the Milky Way. The fact that one of them, which was the Cygnus one, was a long way away was a thing which I think really sort of didn't impinge on us until we got, say, about 50 extragalactic sources and began to realize that they fitted together as a picture, and that we could say, well, if we've got Cygnus A, one of the brightest sources, is that far away, then we're going to see things a lot further away again, and began to put together kind of a statistical picture. And then quite soon after that, we found we were talking about the universe as a whole. It just sort of dawned on us bit by bit.
And how were these observations received by...
We had a lot of fun because whenever you're in a situation like that, you think that you've got all the answers and nobody else has got any answers at all. So for example, the outstanding example was Martin Ryle, who thought that he really had the key to the universe, which he did, and Fred Hoyle, who thought that he understood the cosmology of the universe, which he did, and the two didn't quite fit together. So, there was a pretty hefty clash of outlooks for that bit, yes. And it went on for some time. It was quite exciting.
Sparks did fly, as I recall from the histories, yes. Tell us a little bit about the move to Manchester then. Your work, early work here at Manchester.
My move to Manchester. Oh, well, I was astonished. I was given the first job that I ever had. In Cambridge, I was existing on various grants and fellowships, as everybody has to these days, and I was no exception. And then I was offered the job of sitting in a chair in Manchester, and I could really hardly refuse. Manchester was very remote from Cambridge, you know. It's a very inward-looking society. Perhaps I should be careful how I say that.
No, I think you can.
But from Cambridge, to move to Manchester seemed as though we were moving to the far north. Eventually, we got it on a map and realized it was more west than north and became reconciled to it. And, of course, I now regard myself as a perfect, well, northerner, Midland northerner.
So certainly I can imagine that the centres of intellectual life in Great Britain seem to be more towards down south, let's say, between Oxford and Cambridge. And so Manchester is being has always had that industrial pedigree of being a centre of industrial work and research. But to come and do astronomy up in Manchester...
Well, I think this brings me on to a story that hasn't been told much in public, but I can because there's a member of the Royal Greenwich Observatory, David Calvert, in the audience, and he reminded me at the time when the observatory was at Hurstmonceux and the Research Council wanted to shift it and put it next door or within a university. And after some deliberation, they came down to the idea that it might be either Cambridge or Manchester. And there seemed to be quite a difficult choice to make. So the Research Council made a serious mistake. They actually asked the people who worked at Hurstmonceux where they would rather go to. And they asked their wives as well. And they put a lot of them into an aeroplane, flew them up to Manchester to have a look. And of course, they were all expecting, you know, dirty industrial north. They arrived on a spring day when, you know, the cherry trees were out. They took the wives to have a look at nursery schools. They took some of the young chaps to hike up into the hills and see how marvelous it was. And they went home a bit baffled. And they eventually decided to have a vote on it and voted to go to Cambridge. But the observatory might well have come to Manchester. And I think if it did, it would probably still be in existence. As you know, when it got to Cambridge, it lasted only a few years and was eventually packed up.
That was a remarkable history. I mean, the times that we're talking about here, apart from the state of knowledge of astronomy has changed so much, but also attitudes about what a research institution is and where work like this can be done. Bernard Lovell himself, I mean, his work in Manchester, coming from Bristol, it was a decision which I'm not sure it was considered strange or odd that he should.
Well, he could tell you that story in detail.
Yes,
of course, it was a question of where Blackett was working and where Bragg was, and this was an opportunity. I mean, at that stage, you grab any opportunity you can. I mean, I don't remember ever really seriously turning anything down, and if I was offered a job in Manchester, well, yes, I was. Offered a job in Hurstmonceux to run the Royal Greenwich Observatory. Well, that's a good idea. Let's do that. And the reason for that, of course, was that there was the chance of building the new optical observatory in the Canary Islands and on La Palma. And that was just too good to miss.
Fantastic work. One thing which I'll go back to a little bit about you being a former Astronomer Royal, but it's, I don't know, when I first visited Cambridge some years ago, and I was fresh off the boat, if you like, from New Zealand. I was just visiting, and I bowled up to Sir Martin Rees's door, knocked on it and said, "Hello, I'm Nick from New Zealand. You're the Astronomer Royal. Hi." And he was very polite. Because it's the only thing he can do, I think, is be polite. And I'll ask you the same question I asked him, which was, what does the Astronomer Royal actually do?
Oh, he doesn't have to do anything at all. mind you, he isn't paid for it either. And
it's roughly the same answer he gave.
Doesn't. Well, sometimes it's compared with being poet laureate, but I believe the poet laureate gets a butt of malmsey a year or some such thing, and has actually a designated place in ceremonial processions. And we've never actually quite managed that. Arnold Wolfendale, who was an Astronomer Royal after me, he decided he really ought to rectify this, and I think he was getting as far as designing some sort of medal that he could hang round his neck and ceremonial things. But we've never had anything like that, actually. The thing is, you can do almost what you like with it. And Martin Rees, to his great credit, has used the position to talk about astronomy a great deal. And he has influenced the course of science, I think, quite considerably. If you go back to the time of Woolley, then the Astronomer Royal was a recognized figure all over the world. After all, the Astronomer Royal and the director of Royal Greenwich Observatory were one and the same person. And the Royal Greenwich Observatory at that time was vitally important in navigation all around the world. So he was a personality. And it's said that when Woolley turned up at a meeting overseas, they would just roll out the red carpet for him, you know. I never actually experienced that.
A shame. Now, let's move to one other research interest of yours, and that's pulsars. In particular, the Crab pulsar, which has a long and interesting history of observation here. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, we've been observing it for 40 years, and there are some odd things about its behavior. I mean, by and large, it spins around at 30 times a second. It's losing some of that enormous energy it's got. As a rotating body, it's got a fantastic amount of energy. It's also got a strong magnetic field. So it's like a power generator. You can imagine going into a power station and seeing this generator humming around at 30 times a second. Well, this one's a bit bigger and a bit bigger field. So it's losing energy, and we can watch this happening as it slows down. It has slowed down from, I think, just over 30, about 30.2 times a second, down to about 29, while we've been watching it. And there are some little hiccups in that, which are very interesting, and we're trying to write a paper on it. I've been using the results, which Andrew Lyne largely collects, and I first wrote a draft, I think it was about 5 years ago, and I said, let's call it 35 years of crab observation. Well, I just retitled it the other day as 40 years. It still isn't out. And I daren't show it to you for internal refereeing.
I might suggest we want to push forward that publication. You know, just, let's get that out there.
That's right, yeah. But it is absolutely fascinating. Of course, while I've been here, the new systems for surveying and detecting pulsars have been put into action, largely using the radio telescope in Australia at Parkes. And in that collaboration, more than half of the known pulsars have been discovered and published, allowing a lot of statistical work on where they are, where they came from, what's going to happen to them, and even more exciting from many people's point of view, what is the physics of what happens inside them? Mm. I mean, there you've got an object, the mass of the sun, and only about the size of a city. It's, 20 kilometers across or something. And inside that, the state of matter is such that you can only possibly get anywhere near it in the Large Hadron Collider, which we just heard about in the last podcast, so that you can do physics by standing well back from these energetic objects and trying to find out what they're doing. Also, strangely, outside this solid body, there is a kind of an atmosphere which is very, very energetic. We call it the magnetosphere. And somewhere in that is the source of the radio waves. Now, radio waves are the way in which we observe these things. The silly thing is that after 40 years, we still don't really understand how they're generated in the neutron star atmosphere. Extraordinary. If we knew that, and if we could emulate it, well, my gosh, we'd have a really good radio transmitter.
And the Jodcast could go out across the universe. Splendid idea. But it is, ever since neutron stars were postulated and, you know, a basic model was formulated, later observations were shown to agree with that model. We still don't understand an awful lot about the physics going on inside and, like you mentioned, outside the neutron star. And you alluded to it just earlier on about these glitches in the pulsar times. Tell us a little bit about these glitches and what could possibly be the cause.
Well, solid state physicists, or rather, sort of, should we say, low temperature condensed matter physicists, do understand something about it. If they make a little pot of liquid helium, very, very cold, and spin it, it doesn't spin as a whole. In the normal way, as you can stir a cup of tea and you can see the whole thing going round. Instead, it breaks up into a whole lot of separate little vortices. And if you add the number of vortices up, it'll tell you how fast it's spinning. But it isn't spinning as a whole. Now, you can only do that in a lab in a tiny little bit. But that's what's happening inside the neutron star. Because it's got an outside, which is solid, a solid crystal, largely made of iron. And that's about a kilometer thick. The remaining 9 kilometers down to the center of it is liquid. And it's largely a sea of neutrons. And they're so compressed that they can't help being superfluid, like the superfluid helium in our laboratory. So spin the neutron star 30 times a second, and amazingly, it isn't all going round. It is just threaded with little vortices, some hundreds of them every square millimeter. And as it slows down, So the density of these things has to fall, because it's the density of the vortices that tells you how fast it's spinning. Slows down, vortices have to move out. Well, can they? They have a curious habit of attaching themselves to this crust. So you've got a solid crust inside, a network of vortices which are clamped on to the crust, and so the crust goes slower and slower, and the vortices don't move. That's funny, because the density of the vortices tells you how fast it's going. So you've got an inside which is spinning faster than the outside. Well, that can't go on. It can't go on for long. So eventually something goes ping, and the vortices suddenly move outwards. That's a glitch.
And we see that as a sudden change.
You see that as a sudden change in the rotation. That's why this telescope is being used when it's not on what some people think are more important things of interferometry and so forth, when it's used in its main function, which is looking at pulsars, it's timing the pulses from some hundreds of pulsars and watching the way they slow down and the way these glitches occur. You would never in the laboratory be able to create a situation where you can observe the vortices clutching hold and then letting go in the way that you can in the pulsar. Now, that's just one example of the kind of physics that you can do in a pulsar just by watching, and you can't do it however much you build a great big accelerator or a really cold cryostat.
Do you need 35 years or 40 years to see these glitches, or is it over a shorter timescale?
Well, it's interesting. I was just looking at the record of the timing of the Crab pulsar and a graph which is plotted of its rotation speed against time. Now, that graph is absolutely stuffed with observation points, but after about 3 or 4 years, there's a gap. And then it takes on again after another gap of 3 years, and it keeps going. Now, what happened, I think, after about 3 years, we just got a bit bored. But after a while, we realized we might be missing something. So we started up again, and it's been exciting ever since. So we've never given up again.
It's brilliant. I could sit here and ask questions for hours on end, but I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up there. So we'll say thank you very much to you now for taking the time to speak to us. And ladies and gentlemen, Francis Graham-Smith.